This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, I've had a great week because I've been playing with some steam things in a canal. Brilliant fun.
Lots of shining brass.
Yeah, just
copper.
What's not to like it? We were firmly committed to the power of steam in this programme, and it was steam heaven.
Basically, it's how this programme is driven. We have spoken a lot over the last few months or so about the importance of the marine environment, particularly because the last episode of Blue Planet, which came out from the Natural History Unit in Bristol, for the first time emphasised the fact that there's a lot of plastic in the sea, for example. But there are other problems associated with the marine environment. And if communities want to look after their little patch, what they can look at and see, how do they do it? How would that work in reality? Philip Price is a member of something called the Craignish Restoration of Marine and Coastal Habitats, the rather wonderfully named CRUMH for short.
There was a marine protected area set up all around the sort of south end of Mull, up the Sound of Mull and down the Sound of Jura. And that was set up for flapperskate, which is this utterly incredible animal. It's about 3 metre wingspan animal. It lives for 100 years. It's a giant of the deep. And luckily, through a really incredible story of science and working with fishermen and sportsmen, they realised that they needed help and they set this marine protected area up for it. However, there's no actual protection measures being put in place, so we set up a community group to engage with that marine protected area and try and take the community's point of view to the legislator, to S&H, to the government, to whoever, to say this is what our community wants and try and help deliver that. And since then, it's kind of grown arms and legs. And it's now a voice for the community and trying to actually put more fish back in the sea, because from our perspective, there's just not enough. We should have more fish in the sea and more habitat and more dolphins and more whales. And
when you talk about going to the politicians and saying this is what our community wants, does your community include fishermen? Are they on board with it?
It does, yeah. We have one creel boat going out of Ardfern who are not part of CRUMH, and we have engaged them. We do talk to them on a regular basis, even if that means just in the pub over a glass of whiskey. I think the problem is, at the moment, when you talk about protecting the marine habitat, things need to change. For instance, I think there needs to be a change in the way we farm salmon. There needs to be a change in the way we manage our dredging fleet and manage our trawling fleet to improve the kind of nursery habitats for fish. A lot of fishermen are interconnected with different industries, so even though a creel boat, again, in our opinion, is a really sustainable way of fishing, they may also do contract work occasionally for salmon farming. So I think it's hard for them to get on board with an overall message that maybe we're putting out there, but we certainly do engage. And it's one of our remits, is it's all about sustainable fisheries. It's about making a living from the sea forever, not just for the next 10, 15 years. And that's what we're set up for. But that bridging that gap between, say, people like me who make their living from wildlife and the wildlife operators to the fishermen, that's certainly a challenge.
We've discussed this in the programme umpteen times, that part of the problem with the marine environment is it's by and large invisible, because we're not divers, we're not fish, we're not down there. We don't see, if there's damage being caused, we don't see it.
Absolutely, and this is one of our things that we've done. We've got a couple of guys in the team in Cromach who have just done their tickets to do dry suit diving and are now going to start surveying the bottom so we can see what's down there and we can tell our community what's down there. We're engaged with the scallop divers. They're handpicking scallops and they can see what's going on because they're in the same terrain as some of the other more damaging fishing techniques are working. And also, it's a free-for-all. No one owns the sea, so you can't go to somebody and go, listen, can you stop that happening? Mm-hmm. That just is impossible at the moment. I think more and more communities, there's four or five now set up around here, are saying is that we need something to change. There needs to be some form of protection. Even if it's just small areas that are linked, you know, the science across the world shows that if you just protect some areas, the other areas, the fishing in the other areas, increases because you have nurseries viable again.
I know you are one of the photographers in an organisation called Scotland The Big Picture. What's the intention of that?
Scotland Big Picture is a group of photographers and filmmakers and writers, and essentially we just want to see ecosystems functioning again. That's the overall aim, is to have functioning ecosystems, and that includes people. That's the big thing. That includes food creation. That's not saying we don't want farming, we just want forests. We're saying we want forests, but we want farming too, and we want the two to be able to work together. So Scotland the Big Picture is looking at how we could get an array of rewilded or ecosystem repaired areas that are networked together that benefit people, wildlife, farming. You know, all of us can benefit from that vision, I think. And it's a constantly shifting thing, Scotland the Big Picture, but at the moment it's just trying to get those positive bridge-building messages out. These are solutions. These are things that can help us. These are things that could make the future far more sustainable. And that's my vision for Scotland the Big Picture, is taking it in that direction.
It's an interesting one, that, though, isn't it? Because, you know, the argument with natural history programmes of the BBC for many years was, we need to show people how beautiful things are, how wonderful things are, you know, almost the Eden version of what's actually going on. There was a counter-argument which actually didn't, until recently, didn't get any traction at all, which was, yeah, but show them the stuff that isn't working. Show them the stuff where the environment has been degraded. Just, and sometimes it's like, I mean, I was talking to Doug Allen quite recently, and he was saying, you know, if you turned the camera 25 degrees, you'd have picked up an entirely different story. Mm. But for a long time, you know, that was not the editorial thrust. So, yes, you can show the beautiful stuff in Scotland, but do you also have to show the stuff where, actually, this is a bit of a mess?
It's a tricky one. Yes, I think absolutely you do.
But things, do people want to see it?
Well, this is the thing. This is the way I've come to think of it. So guilt only works for so long. You don't empower people by making them feel guilty. They switch off. Eventually, they go, oh, it's just nothing I can do. This mm-hmm. is too hard. I just don't want to see that anymore. Mm. Whereas hope and excitement and, wow, we can do this, that gains traction and that can go forever. Mm-hmm. No one gets bored of hope. No one gets bored of being excited. I mean, you just look at the movie industry. People love to be excited. That movie industry has lasted for hundreds, you know, 100 years or whatever. And it's just getting bigger. And I think that's the message I like to try and put out there. And it's not saying everything we've got is brilliant, but it's giving maybe a route to somewhere where it could be brilliant and showing people that there is a way of getting there. And yeah, you've got to highlight the issues as the starting point, but I think hope is a far more powerful tool than guilt.
Cromach board member Philip Price there, and I think he's got a point.
Yeah, he's got a point, but I think you do need a bit of guilt, because the Blue Planet programme, that was the impression I got, is actually we're making a real mess of this. Yeah. So you probably start with the guilt and then move on to hope. What are we going to do about it?
Talking about, we spoke about the fact there's plastic in the sea, and you can see that, it's kind of floating, it ends up on the beaches. That stuff's visible, no great problem. In fresh water, in rivers, they are beginning to find plastic, which inevitably ends up down in the sea. In Australia, they've been worried about that for some time. So what they do is they put like big nylon bags on the outflows, the drainage things, and every so often they clear the plastic out of that before it hits the sea. You know, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yep.
Somebody was talking about using plastic to create roads. Now, it looks like road surface, tarmac road surface, but how does it wear? If it produces microparticles of plastic, where are they going to go? Okay. Inevitably, down to the sea.
Yeah, because I think we had the first one in Scotland just last week.
Uh-huh.
But you're right, as it wears away, it's going to enter the system.
Yeah.
Just get rid of plastic.
Well, I think it'll probably head that way one of these fine days, but we're a long way away from it yet.
We've got a wee piece later on which may well go some way to solving some of the plastic issues.
Come springtime, and it was about a month ago, every garden has got daffodils in it. We've got lots and lots of daffodils in our gardens, different types. They come in many varieties. An early pioneer in daffodil hybridisation was a fellow called William Backhouse. And to this day, the name of Backhouse is still very much associated with the flower. Rossi Estate in Fife is home to a collection of rare heritage daffodils. And Caroline Thompson, who's a direct descendant of the Backhouse family, and I hope you're following this, showed me around the garden.
The Backhouse nursery in its heyday, my ancestors' nursery, was enormous. There were 40 glasshouses. We, of course, are no longer on this scale, but we continue the important part of the ethos that they had then. During spring, these daffodils flower, and they're important in the cultivation of daffodils. They're the first tetraploid and two of the first triploid cultivars. Every species has an optimum number of chromosomes. In daffodils, it's tetraploidy. They're stronger and they're more healthy. They don't require so much support or intervention, and they grow very well. This daffodil here, so much stemmed from that daffodil. It has a very important place in daffodil history, as do Empress. We have these beautiful doubles, some of these very first doubles, and the early Martigan lilies. Mrs. R.A. Backhouse produced stormingly fantastic red cupped daffodils. And
stormingly fantastic, I like that.
Stormingly fantastic. And Engelhardt, who was himself a giant in the daffodil world, said of her on her death that in her work you could see the vast difference between talent and genius. And in the garden, when I go there in the evening, I look to Sarah Backhouse. If I'm struggling in any way, I find her determination and her focus on her work to produce these beautiful daffodils, inspiring, encouraging and supporting.
Did you have this interest in daffodils before you got this place?
Yes, I did. My mother actually planted the first pink cup daffodil that you can see here with R.O. Backhouse. And she's always had an interest and wanted to encourage us. And she has a natural ability to plant and understand colours and shapes and form and to identify plants which are of interest. And I think she's passed that on to me. My very first job was weeding on the schools in St Andrews. I used to weed the gardens. I have an RHS level 2 and I worked in the garden at Crathys Castle as well. So, yes, throughout my life I've had an interest.
So this is the walled garden?
This is the walled garden. So all the plants we have here have some history, and but they have a fragility too. For example, these Erica Carnea from the 1911 catalogue, which commemorated the coronation of King George.
All the various, because obviously, you know, this is the National Collection of Daffodils. All the various types of daffodils, where do you find early examples of them? How do you identify them?
Well, we work with experts, and there is now DNA testing as well to double-check what you've got and what you're doing. For us, we've been very lucky in that we have our ancestors' diaries and their daffodil breeding notes, and we still have a lot of our elderly aunts and uncles and family relatives still alive whose properties are possibly the name of the daffodil, or their grandparents were the name of the daffodil. So you go reading? So we've been round to our family and talked to them and said, we're nervous that of the 956 daffodils that were produced, there were, when we started, only 13 still available. Because they fall off the catalogue lists and are replaced on the list by whatever is new for the season. And therefore, their only place is very often with our elderly aunts, for example. And we've asked if we can take a bulb or two. We've propagated them up here, and our process now is returning bulbs plus a few more to say thank you, and of various other varieties, so that there is a duplicate collection of the daffodils that we have here around the family gardens. When different varieties are lost, the effect may not be immediate, but it will almost always be felt. Mm-hmm. And for example, with daffodils, galanthamine is one of the alkaloids found in the alkaloid shades that is being used to treat mild to moderate Alzheimer's.
Right. How many people work this garden?
Well, we have the gardener, the groundsman. We have two volunteers. We had students here from Erasmus programme. So a variety of people, but there's a solid core. My husband and I are very much involved as well. And there's the folk in the cafe who like to come down and pick the herbs and the edible flowers in the morning.
Sorry, there's the most glorious smell of something there. I don't know what it's really sort of honeyed and sweet.
Ah, here we are. It's this.
I'm trying to think if I can just step in there without crushing stuff. Wow, that's lovely.
These are narcissus.
Yeah.
They're beautiful. These are Poeticus recurvus, which means their petals are going backwards. The scent is wonderful.
I know you are a garden designer to trade. Explain these borders to me.
Well, initially, I planted them geopolitically, so plants from countries that rubbed along together. The plants were to rub along together too. Uh-huh. But as is the way with plants and gardeners, horticulture overarches politics, and that was the point of the planting. The importantness of being human and nature, those long-term evolutionary ideas and what makes them work and the ethos behind that overarches this short-term politics. It's a rubbing along that I enjoy. And this, in a way, this is the very heart of the garden and was the start of the design process, because many gardens are really about the families that make them.
Caroline Thompson of Rossi Estate, and it's an interesting place, that garden. It's not, I have to say, I spoke to Caroline about this afterwards, it's not as well signposted as it might be, but it's well worth finding. It's a lovely walled garden, and because the family were Quaker, that ethos has kind of moved its way through, so they're trying to produce as little impact on the landscape as possible, maintain these species. The cafe ties in, the cafe goes out and raids the garden in the morning, gets as much fresh stuff as they can, and actually builds that into their menus. It's a nice idea.
Well, by keeping an alien species alive.
It's not an alien species. Why is it an alien species?
Because it came in from abroad.
So? Lots of plants came in from abroad.
Doesn't make it right.
Yeah. Didn't land on a spaceship. Anyway, Ella, this week, you were down. This is actually, I liked the sound of this, because it's not often you sound genuinely carted away with excitement. But in this occasion,
we could have. We'd
never been out of
it. It was one of those few occasions I said, goodness me, I wish Mark was here. So, I was down in Bonnybridge for what was being billed as a canal carnival. Because, basically what happened, there was a couple of bridges between the Forth and Clyde Canal that were said to be unsafe, so they closed the canal. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of money, and it looked like they were going to close the canal, we're going to lose it. You couldn't go from east to west, west to east. But somebody found the money from somewhere, and they reopened it this weekend. And there they were, boats coming up the canal and a lone piper on the bridge.
My name is Ronnie Rusak. I've been involved in the canal since 1971. Used to own the bridge in at Rathoe. This boat here was built by volunteers. It's an ex-Scottish Canals boat, and it's now used for maintenance work by volunteers throughout the whole of the canal system.
And you're going to be skipper on this one in full fig?
I'm going to be doing that in fancy dress and also with a full band on board for tomorrow.
Tell me why we're here. What are we celebrating? A beautiful wee puffer coming down there.
Well, if you had been here 18 months ago, Ewan, you'd have found that the canal was in great threat, serious threat of being closed, and closed for good.
Why?
Because the bridge behind us here at Bonnybridge was broken, and also a bridge at Twyker was broken. and it just was going to be a disaster. So what we did, we formed a group called Keep Canals Alive, which included all the canal societies, all the bodies and charities on the canal to help Scottish Canals, really, to try and get extra funding to get the canal reopened. So it meant lobbying a lot of MSPs and the Transport Department. And fortunately, we were so delighted that the Transport Department found it really worthwhile to actually give them the extra $7 million that was required and get the canal reopened again.
How big a battle was it getting the funding?
It was huge, really. If it hadn't been for the support of many Scottish MSPs and, say, the Transport Department, it wouldn't have happened.
My heart is being lifted at the moment. We've got your boat coming and a beautiful steam launch coming in, and a tiny steam launch behind that, and a replica puffer. I mean,
beautiful, isn't it?
Delightful sight, beautiful. And Swan coming in.
Yeah.
What are people going to see this weekend?
Well, they're going to see 71 boats going through the canal. Everybody will be dressed up in fancy dress. They'll have music on board their boats. It's a pure canal carnival this time, not just a flotilla, but a carnival.
And where can people see it? Where's the best place over Saturday and Sunday?
Well, it'll start off at the Falkirk Wheel around about 8:30 in the morning, and it'll be heading out through Bonnybridge, out through Wineford, and then reaching Auchinstarre.
I'm Catherine Topley, I'm the Chief Executive from Scottish Canals.
Richard Miller, Director of Infrastructure at Scottish Canals.
How big a deal is this, getting these bridges open?
It's significant. As you know, the canals are fundamental to the communities, and they're also fundamental to other communities as well, not just the local community. So the boating community, with the cyclists, the walkers. So having the boats coming through and being able to go from sea to sea transit is a significant achievement.
What was the problem with the bridges?
The bridges had been part of the Millennium Link 20 years ago, and they'd really just, parts of them were starting to fail, and it was around about safety that we had to close the bridges. But working with the volunteers and working with some really inspired engineers, we've been able to find solutions to these bridges. Scottish Government invested in them last summer, and since then, in a 9-month programme, we've been able to, from absolutely a blank piece of paper, to transform these bridges and get them back up and operational.
Because if the government hadn't come on board, presumably it was looking a bit dodgy.
Yes, sadly, the assets in the canal, are some of them are 250 years old, so that comes with the challenges of maintaining them and ensuring that they are, as Richard says, safe for use for the public and for all. And there are occasions where they're not safe. So had we not had been fortunate for the government to find the additional money, then this sadly would not have been happening today.
You're on the Mary Hill. Tell me what the Mary Hill is.
Well, the Mary Hill is a 2/3 size puffer. And puffers obviously used to sail on the canal at one time, having been built in the Kirkintilloch area. So she's 2/3 size of what a normal puffer would be.
So she's perfect for this run today.
Oh, yes, indeed. Oh, it's a wonderful vessel to sail on the canal. And it's a wonderful feature to see. Cameras are out every time it comes onto the water. We love it.
What's it like seeing that bridge open again after such a long time, when it looked like it might not happen?
Yes, we were all worried about that sort of situation, but it's wonderful now to have it back in operation, and we have CTC traffic coming through the canal again. It's great to see the yachts coming through from the east going west and vice versa later on in the year. Absolutely wonderful.
Have a good trip.
Thank you.
Michael Matheson, Cabinet Secretary for Transport, Infrastructure and Connectivity.
How pleased are you seeing this opening today? Because without the Scottish Government input, this wouldn't have happened.
Well, I'm delighted to see the opening of the new bridge today, because it's a strategic element of the whole canal network between Glasgow and going east of the country. And that's why we saw it as being important to step in and to support Scottish Canals to make sure that this repair could be carried out. It will allow the canal to operate fully again, which is extremely important. And there's absolutely no doubt that it will bring real benefit to canal users and to tourists who are looking to actually make use of the canals.
Are you going to continue to fund it, though, I suppose?
Well, we've increased funding to Scottish Canals in their existing budget in this financial year to help to support them to make some of the infrastructure investments they need to make. Our canal network is absolutely crucial to a number of our rural parts of Scotland, but including in areas such as here in Bonnybridge, my own constituency. And that's why it's extremely important we make sure we provide them with the support that they require. We can see the work that they're doing in other parts of the canal network, which is a result of the additional funding that we're providing them with. And it's making sure that they're able to maintain and to also sustain the canal network in a usable fashion so that those who have got canal boats can get the benefit of it and those who want to use the waterways are able to get the benefit of it as well.
It's a fantastic site, isn't it?
It's a great site. It's a fantastic location, Bonnybridge in itself, but it's also a unique bridge in how it operates. And the festival over the course of this weekend in itself will give people from right across the country an opportunity to come and see some fantastic vessels, including steam vessels, which will be on the canal, and also to see the fantastic Falkirk wheel and also the bridge that we have here in Bonnybridge.
What's not to like?
Exactly. So it's great to see this, and it will be a real festival environment over the course of the next couple of days.
Oh, come on! No! It was a great atmosphere. Oh, what was interesting as well, you've got an MSP, a cabinet minister, being welcomed and patted on the back by all those boaties saying, well done. Because usually people...
Usually
there's an egg being crashed in the back of your jacket. Yeah. But yeah, it was a great atmosphere. Beautiful, beautiful boats. The noise you're hearing in the background...
It's not a steam yacht.
It's not a steam yacht. It's somebody in a souped-up car with a big exhaust who likes the sound of boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, burbling away. Oh, there you go, look at that. He's playing with it. He must have been listening to it.
Sounds like
two of them, actually.
It's going to get better.
That's definitely two.
Well, it might be a Harley, is it?
Yeah, a hardly drivable. Yeah, there you go. He's off. Quite happy.
Off for his Sunday ride.
Yeah, I have seen one of those little steam launches, and it's just a riot of shining copper and brass and, you know, the smoke pluming out and what have you. Beautiful wee thing.
Mahogany and pine and just so much love lavished on them. And they were all dressed in Victorian dress. And over the weekend there's going to be a jazz band playing, or a great carnival atmosphere.
Yeah. Oh, well worth going to see.
There he goes.
Azovsky. Anyway, a couple of years ago, we met two lovely American ladies who got in contact with us to say, look, we started downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast because we wanted to learn some Scottish. We were coming to Scotland to visit. And then they thought, actually, that sounds quite interesting, and we can go and see that, and we can go and see that. So they used the podcast to inform their journeys. They enjoyed it so much. They were across for 2.5 months in their first year. They enjoyed it so much, they both came back separately last year, and they're back again this year. I met up with them in Oban. They're called Susan Maxwell and Sharon Dewey Zivaki. And I said, OK, what is it about this place that keeps you, keeps you coming back?
Both of us grew up in military families and not being from anywhere. And that being a question we were probably asked our whole lives, where are you from, where are you from? And I think both of us, through the planning process of coming the first time, which we spent over a year planning, and then getting here and our experience here, we found our heart home. I think we found the place we want to call home, even though we can't at this time, but maybe someday.
we're working on that for sure. But yeah, it just on every single level, Scotland, the people, the place, the history, the landscape, it just totally speaks to what we love and where we want to be. Yeah.
How does it compare to home?
So we're both from Parker, Colorado. And actually, we just got pictures sent to us. There's 5-6 inches of snow on the ground today. We have the mountains, obviously, in Colorado. No ocean, so that's one of the appeals of Scotland. You can find everything here. The ocean, the mountains, the flatlands, the moors, the name it. Okay. It's here. Other than deserts, which we're both tired of anyway.
We're both tired of the desert, yeah. We come for the moisture, believe it or not.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right.
Very good for the skin.
We're slightly disappointed when it doesn't rain.
Right, right.
Now, you've been here how many days now?
I've been here a week and a half.
Week and a half. Yeah. Tell me what you did in the week and a half.
I flew to Edinburgh and got acclimated the first 2 days. I was planning on a long walk across the Afrikantel Way. Mm-hmm. Then I went to Drumnadrocket and started the walk from there. And hiked through the Glen Afric area and then Kintail area, and it took me 5 days. I stayed an extra day at the hostel, the most remote hostel in Scotland, which is amazing and fabulous, and we were told to all go preach that gospel so that people would come to that hostel.
And it won't be the most remote one anymore.
Then that's why I'm a little nervous about saying anything, but it was spectacular. I had two beautiful days of sunshine, and then the rain came. But tent camping in the rain for the first time by myself was a learning experience, a big learning curve, but I still loved it and loved every minute of the hike. It was just a beautiful walk. It was something I just like to do just by myself. And one of the reasons I don't do it in Colorado but come here to do that is there's no predators here. I wouldn't go alone hiking in Colorado because of the bears and the mountain lions and moose or whatever. And so that's one of the reasons I come here, is because as a woman, I feel totally able and capable and free. I mean, I plan and I prepare well, but to do that without the fear of any kind of predator coming after me. So
my trip was not as adventurous as Sharon's.
Yet.
That's true. That's true. So I flew into Glasgow, came over to Edinburgh, and again, just got to visit some of my very, very favorite places. Got to see a lot of new ones. You think you know Edinburgh pretty well, and then you go down a close or a wind or a street or a whatever, and there's a whole new adventure in front of you. And again, just met the greatest mm-hmm. people who were so gracious and took the time to explain the history of the street that I was on, and you know, what it was like when they were growing up and what it's like now and where they see things going. And they give you time. And
they don't in Colorado?
People are friendly in Colorado. It's just, it's different.
It's a different pace. I think that's another thing that brings us here. I don't know if it's America just in general or Denver area in particular, but it's just a go, 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 go. Work, 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 work. Get home, close your garage door, you know, and then close yourself off till you go do it again. And I'm really tired of that lifestyle. I'm really tired of work being the total epicenter of life. So for me personally, when I come here and shops close at 5, I think that's amazing.
Exactly.
And I love it because that means people have gone home or they're out on the street talking to each other. They're spending time with family and friends. And everyone you meet here on the trail, this was something I was going to say that I don't experience hiking in Colorado. Every time you meet someone on the trail in Scotland, they say, hiya, and they will stop and say, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. They really care that you're okay on your walk.
I'm really pleased to hear that. And I know that you're both catching a ferry from here, Oban, tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
What are you heading off to do?
We're out to see everything that we can on the Outer Hebrides. We're going all the way from Barra all the way up to the very top, to the Butt of Lewis, right?
Yeah.
To the lighthouse there, mm-hmm. as far as you can go. Hopefully we can maybe even squeeze in a trip to St. Kilda. Fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
St. Kilda's magical. It's just otherworldly.
That's how we feel about coming to Scotland.
Really?
Like, we can't pick a place. We both talk about where would you move, and we can't pick a place yet. But
your husbands must be getting suspicious by now, surely.
Well, I've got mine about convinced that this would be a good idea. So we're working on Sharon's husband, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
But
not likely. But there's long-distance relationships. I've heard of those.
Yeah, well, it's a genuine pleasure seeing you both back.
Nice
talking to you again, too.
Thanks for everything that you do. You have no idea how much we both look forward to Saturday, where we just binge Scotland outdoors. We do. And it brings it all back and makes us want to come back for more.
That's right.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Susan and Sharon, they're lovely women.
Who'd have thought we would find useful?
Yes, it came as a surprise to me too.
Very
to
uncomfortable feeling. But
yeah.
There's quite a few folk we get in touch, though.
Indeed. The Scotland Outdoors podcast has a reasonable reach, it has to be said. Robert Jones says, I've only just found this programme. It's great. I wish we had a rural affairs programme in Somerset. I've visited Scotland quite a few times, so I don't feel detached from the content.
And Billy Fisher also emailed. He said, a quick message to say hello and keep up the good work. I'm listening to the show from our home in Palma de la Mallorca, although I'm from Dundee myself. That's from Billy, Nisa, mm-hmm. and baby Lara.
Excellent. Last year, we brought you news that the Rowett Institute, which is a scientific research institute just outside Aberdeen, was looking at gorse, you know, the yellow flowering plant, as a possible protein source that could rival soybeans. Well, that research has actually been galloping on apace. And the Institute are now looking at other crops which were once grown in Scotland and could well be an essential part of the food chain in years to come.
Yeah, I've been talking to Dr. Wendy Russell from the Druid about the fascinating developments, including the possibility of using plant protein to control diabetes instead of drugs. But we started our chat beside an ancient piece of machinery that links Scotland's past with its possible future.
At the moment, we're looking at a windwheel. It's an agricultural piece of equipment that was used long ago to mill gorse. They would have used gorse to feed animals at times when crops were short, particularly over the winter months.
It's an art that's been lost, though. I mean, everybody does a double take when you say you're going to eat gorse.
Absolutely. It's definitely not something that's on the food agenda at the moment, but it's something we're looking at seriously to provide protein for the future.
So are gorse, is gorse particularly strong in protein?
Gorse is rich in protein. It's around 17% in protein, but it also contains quite large amounts of dietary fibre. It's rich in micronutrient vitamins and minerals and a whole range of bioactive molecules that we think prevent some of the non-communicable diseases like type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease.
Because there is going to be pressure to find sources of protein in the future.
There certainly is. From 1950 to 2000, the population doubled and meat intake increased fivefold. By 2050, when we've got more than 9 billion people on the planet, we just can't feed that amount of people with meat. We can't produce enough crops. We don't have enough land or water to produce that amount of animals.
We're good at growing gorse in Scotland.
We certainly are. If you look at Scotland's landmass, there's not an awful lot of land available for growing arable crops. We grow peas and beans very well. They're very good protein sources. But we've been looking to the future and how we might leverage some other protein from the system and where we could harvest that from. Wild plants are particularly important because they can grow well on the marginal lands. They also need little inputs. They don't need fertiliser or pesticides. And if we can utilise them as a protein supply, it'd be really interesting. The thing about gorse is that it's actively been removed. It's quite invasive. So it's something that's been removed from our system already. So it wouldn't cause any particular problems if we were to get protein from that as a source.
You're also looking at other plants as well.
We certainly are. We were looking at other invasive plants such as broom and bracken, but even things that are grown in the cities or close to the cities, such as buddleia and fireweed, might be potential sources of protein for the future.
But you're also encouraging Scottish farmers to have a look at some other interesting crops.
We are interested in crops that are currently in the food system that could be grown in Scotland. We know peas and beans grow well, but there are other crops such as hemp and buckwheat that we're particularly interested in. These have been historically grown in Scotland and could grow here again.
Well, what is hemp anyway?
Hemp's a really interesting agricultural product. Every part of the plant can be used. It's been used for building materials, but the seeds can be pressed to make an oil or milk, and what's left over from the seeds could also be an important food source.
Because you've actually got a bit of hemp bread here, which I'm going to try. Just tastes like bread.
It does, and we've designed a cookbook to try and encourage people to get more of these products into their diet. If our farmers are going to grow the crop, we have to make sure that we can process it and provide it and that people want to eat it, and I think that's really important.
And you've got a trial coming up at the moment.
We have. Another product that we're interested in is buckwheat. We've found some really interesting molecules in buckwheat that we think might help prevent and manage type 2 diabetes. So we're currently recruiting people from the local area, either with type 2 diabetes or healthy people or people who are controlling their diabetes with diet or drugs to come along and be recruited for our study.
So that's potentially not relying on drugs then?
It would be good if we can impact on people's blood sugar using a food product, especially something like buckwheat that we could put into lots of different foods. We could put it into bread or drinks and it could become a part of a person's regular diet.
Going back to hemp, you've had a bit of an uphill battle to grow it.
We've been working on hemp for some time now. Started in around 2011 when we began to do some research on it. We really would like to see hemp grown in the fields in Scotland again, but it's taken some time to show that it's a beneficial food and to encourage people to grow it. But we currently have a group of stakeholders, including farmers and processors, who are really interested in thinking about trying to get hemp grown again in Scotland.
But you have to have a licence for it.
You do. Hemp obviously is related to marijuana, and there's obviously been concerns in the past that how it's grown and where it's grown. So currently farmers have to apply for a licence. That licence has to be renewed annually, and it possibly discourages a lot of farmers from growing hemp at the moment.
Well, why does it have to be licensed? Is it full of opioids?
It isn't. There's very negligible amounts of THC, which is the compound that's in marijuana. This is agricultural hemp that we're talking about. It really is an agricultural product and doesn't contain any of these compounds.
So it's just an outdated system, is it?
Possibly. And I think if we can start to encourage farmers to grow it and for processors to process it, maybe we can change policy and it might not be something that needs to have a licence.
Dr. Wendy Russell from the Rout Institute. And that business about having to have a licence to grow hemp is nuts.
It's nonsense. It's just a hangover. Hemp, oh, marijuana.
Ooh.
Well, no, it's not got any...
Yeah. Marijuana tiny, madness.
Tiny percentage. I mean, the simple things. You're not allowed to grow hemp near a church.
Yes.
In case it causes offence.
You know that, you know, the blocks of phenolic foam, the insulating material, right. It's usually about 4 inches thick, something like that, and it's foiled on either side. Now, obviously, you know, that's made from oil in the initial stages, but you can get exactly the same thing, which is made out of hemp fibre, which has actually got a lower yield value. In other words, it's a better insulator and material, and it's natural, and it breathes.
But there's also this whole food miles thing and the plastic thing. People are starting to turn the clock back and have a look at it.
Yeah.
You know, people all got their coal in hemp sacks.
Yes.
People used a hemp rope.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you can extract protein from it, it sorts out a lot of the food miles because we can grow hemp in Scotland. We have done for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great foods resource. It's a great animal feed. Mm-hmm. You can use it to make shoes. It's a great plant to have. And to have some kind of archaic restrictions on it just seems daft.
Ah, indeed. Listen, we are always keen to hear of new walking routes on the programme. And the other week I went along to the outskirts of Kelty in Fife to meet up with Ed Heather Hayes of the Fife Coast and Countryside Trust. He'd offered to give me a wee preview of a long-distance route which will be opening up shortly called the Pilgrim Way. And if all things go to plan, in July, that should be open for business.
This is the old open cast site at St Ninian's, and this is the last piece in the puzzle for us to open the route. So the rest of the route is in place, and all we need to do here is just a few basic bits of work, put in a few short sections of path, a few gates, and then we can open the entire route, which will take us from North Queen's Ferry in Kuros to Dunfermline, and then from Dunfermline right through Central Fife to St Andrews.
I have passed this area. Oh. Dozens and dozens and dozens of times going up and down to Edinburgh. And you see this wonderful landscaping off on the left-hand side if you're heading north. What's the aim of it at the end of the day?
Well, the idea was always to transform this once open-cast mining site into a site for public recreation. Mm-hmm. And all the land art that you see here was the idea of Charles Jenks, who is a well-renowned land artist. And what he's done here is... using the massive equipment that was used for quarrying this site, they've then pushed all the spoil and earth around, and they've created this great designed landscape, which the idea behind it is to reflect Scotland's place in the world. So these four giant mounds of earth that you can see, they reflect the four major continents where immigration from Scotland has taken place and where Scotland has had an impact on the wider world.
I have to say, that message missed me completely. I thought it was a fort.
Yeah, I suppose if you're not told that, you wouldn't necessarily know it. But if you go to the top of the mound that most people will be familiar with, which has got the pile of tyres and trees on top of it, along with all the old gear mechanisms and whatnot, worn out pieces of machinery from the quarrying, there is some sort of interpretive landscaping there that does shed a bit more light on it. There's a stone map of Europe with different place names, and I think from a vantage point, a high vantage point, you'll get a better understanding of what it's about.
And what's the raison d'etre for this path through inland Fife? Because there's been a Fife coastal path for a while, but this is to take you inside Fife.
That's right, and that's one of the lovely things about the Pilgrim Way for me, is that it's often a part of Fife that I've driven through the central part of Fife, but it's never really been clear how to access it and enjoy it. But it is a really beautiful landscape all the way through there, with some beautiful villages and some great heritage along the way to explore as well. So what this path does is it takes people right through the middle of that now, and it takes people to parts of Fife that are less visited, but, you know, very much worthwhile the visit.
Yeah.
It's a real cross-section of landscapes and culture and heritage that you get from walking this route. You've got the industrial west with all the sort of hidden heritage, if you like, that goes with that. You're then into the sort of coal fields and rural areas through, you know, heading east from here, you're into Kelty, Lockall Meadows, again, another reclaimed mining site. And then from there, you're up into Kinglassie, the old mining territories there. But you've got these constant flow of high points, and you can look back from where you've come from, and you can look to where you're going across these high points through Fife. It really is tremendous. And then as you get out into the east, you're into that sort of rural landscape, and there's some really very beautiful landscapes out there that I think a lot of people in Fife drive through and appreciate, but have up until now found it quite difficult to get out and explore that on foot.
I like the idea of calling it a pilgrim trail too, because there is so much history of that. I mean, North Queensbury, South Queensbury, the ferry that was invested, that was paid for pilgrims by Queen Margaret, St. Margaret.
Yep.
You know, the route that came all the way up to St. Andrews. This is one of the holiest sites in Europe, St. Andrews.
It was. I mean, it really was. It was Britain's answer, really, to Santiago de Compostela. Mm-hmm. It was a major site of pilgrimage. I mean, thousands of people came from all over the British Isles, Ireland and Europe to come and see the relics of St. Andrew there at St. Andrews. And then, of course, that pilgrimage extended to St. Margaret as well. So Queen Margaret died in 1092, thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't until about 1250 that she was canonised and became St. Margaret. She was interred at Dunfermline Abbey. And then, of course, Dunfermline became a major site of pilgrimage as well, where people came to visit the relics in the shrine of St. Margaret before going on their way to St. Andrews. And that then became very much a royal pilgrimage. So pilgrimage was in its heyday in Fife and across Europe between the 11th and the 16th centuries.
How much of the idea of this long-distance route inland of Fife is actually to try and do with economic regeneration?
Well, that's a big driver behind it. To get people out enjoying the landscape, enjoying the culture, enjoying the heritage of inland Fife, okay, that brings with it a lot of benefits in terms of health and well-being, but of course there is also a very strong economic driver behind that. A study was done in 2006 looking at the feasibility and the possible economic benefits of a Fife Pilgrim Way. And that predicted that in year one there would be around 120,000 visits. Now that doesn't tell us very much, because a visit could be somebody walking their dog on the path where they've walked it every day for the last 20 years. But what the next prediction is that after 3 or 4 years, that number of visits would go up to 200,000. So the important bit of information there is that rise in visits of 80,000 over that time. And then each time somebody visits the path, particularly people who are coming from further afield, they're spending money. So what we're able to do is to put a sort of per-person contribution to the economic benefit of Fife on that. And after year four, the prediction is that there'll be about a £2 million contribution to the economy of Fife directly through visitors coming to the Fife Pilgrim Way.
While we're talking about predictions, I wouldn't be at all surprised if it re-established itself as a genuine route of pilgrimage. Because it would happen with the Camino Real.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. There's massive support for this project, far more than I had expected, actually. And that support...
Always a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. That support and interest, it comes from a wide range of people. And yeah, there is very much a market there for genuine religious pilgrimage. But there's, I think, perhaps an even bigger market for people who just want to get out, explore the heritage, explore the landscape, and to enjoy all the benefits of long-distance walking that comes with it.
Ed Heatherhayes of Fife Coast and Countryside Trust. And you know that patch we're talking about, the former open cast mine.
Yeah, it's former open cast mine and a quarry, I think it was. And they've converted it for what was going to be probably Scotland's biggest recreational park for mountain bikers and sailors and swimmers. Hasn't happened yet.
No, it hasn't happened yet. And I'm not terribly certain what's happening. And Ed was saying they've been trying to get hold of the company that actually runs it. I can't remember the name of that. To say to them, look, we need just you to sign off on this so we can get these three gates in, and that's it. It's all done. The entire route is finished.
So where does it end up at St. Andrews, does it?
It will finish up at St. Andrews.
So where does it start?
I think... Well, see, that was interesting, because I thought it would start in North Queensbury, but I think he said it started at Kouros. which is further along the river.
Could be.
I need to find that. We should do that.
We should do that. It'd be a nice wee cycle.
Yeah. I could give that a go.
Yeah. Now, do you know the call of a crested tit?
No.
No, we don't. Can you tell the difference in a golden eagle and a buzzard?
Yes,
you
can.
The Cairngorm National Park Authority and Speyside Wildlife are offering to young people the place on a specialised nature identification course, basically to get them off on a career of conservation, because it's increasing in demand and it needs people to lead it with knowledge. The Cairngorm is home to 25% of the UK's endangered species list, which is considerable. But it is the perfect setting for the course. And also, as we said, there's a real need for it. Sally Dowden is the owner of Speyside Wildlife.
We are a wildlife tour operating company based in the Cairngorms National Park, and we run fully inclusive holidays and other wildlife watching experiences, both here around Scotland and the rest of the world, from the Arctic to the Antarctic.
Now, we're looking out over the Cairngorms. It is beautiful, a vast array of different habitats, but taking people out as a wildlife guide, you can't learn that overnight. It must take a long time to build up the knowledge.
It does take a long time to build up the knowledge. My senior guides who've worked with me in Speyside Wildlife virtually since we started the business, I think I always say they came out of the womb carrying a pair of binoculars, and their love in life is the great outdoors and the wildlife that's found in it. And from young children, they've spent every few minutes of their spare time looking at the natural environment and learning more about it.
Which is great if you've had the luxury to learn, the luxury of other employment, to spend a lot of time out there at weekends or whatever. But as a young person coming into it, must almost be a non-starter, because being brutal about it, we're looking out at this landscape. I was hearing some curlew earlier on, but you're not seeing much. You have to be able to say, listen to that oyster catcher, or listen to that, to add the extra layer on.
Precisely, and that was the issue that we came up against a few years ago, when we realised that on the odd occasions when I was interviewing somebody for a guiding opportunity with Speyside Wildlife, that people are charming and very sociable, and they would be great to send out with people, but the mechanism for allowing them to have that learning just hasn't been there for probably a considerable period of time. And that because we channel young people into education, training, etc., that spare time and the ability to just be in the great outdoors, maybe as a volunteer, maybe just because you can, is not there for a lot of young people.
So does that mean that career path is denied to folk till they're 40, 50, whatever?
To a certain extent, I think the answer to that is true. I see young people nowadays, and they're the children of some of my guides and others, and they have the same immersion in the natural environment as their parents have had. But I think we have lost the ability at some point in between for children to have that immersion. And there are lots of other things competing for children's wishes and wants and needs nowadays. And that was why we sat down 5 years ago and said, we need to do something about this. The courses that exist to give people identification knowledge do not give that kind of immersion to enable young people and others to get to a point when they can go out in the great outdoors and hear something and say, yes, that is a curlew, and not say, I don't know what it is because I can't see it.
I'll give a wee anecdote here. If somebody didn't know what they're doing, I was on the island of Muck, and the tour guide of a well-known Western Isles cruise company said to his guests, if you look over there in the Coolans, you'll see the flock of eagles.
Oh, dear.
And I took him to one side. You can't say that. Sorry, I'll digress. But
but it's true. It's true. And I learnt a long, long time ago, and my guides will tell you in no uncertain terms, that I am not qualified enough to take people out wildlife watching in the great outdoors. I don't have their kind of knowledge. But I learnt a long time ago that if you make something up, or if you get it wrong because you're too frightened, to be honest, that it's too far away and you can't identify by it. It's nine times out of ten, they are birds, and they will get up and they will fly straight towards you, and they will sit in front of you, and it will be obvious that you've just made it up and you've got it wrong, and you can't do that.
But you've got together with a national park to give a couple of young folk a really golden opportunity to get a job as a wildlife guide.
Yes, yes.
So what are you doing?
So when we decided we had to do something about giving people the knowledge and experience to be able to start to develop 2 or 3 years ago, we have run 12-month long courses. We're now at the start of our third year, and we've been absolutely delighted at the kind of knowledge and experience we've been able to give people. And so we have got together with the National Park Authority to enable two young people to actually share that same opportunity, who might not be able to afford to pay the fee to come on a 12-month course by themselves because of their age.
So they've got 12 months stealing from the brains of experts.
Yes, 12 months stealing from the brains of experts. However, nobody who comes on the course comes without the full knowledge that most of the work over the 12 months will be done by themselves. We put a huge emphasis on people actually producing their own field notebooks over those 12 months to prove to everyone that they've been out in the great outdoors, they've actually gone through the identification process to work out for themselves why what they're looking at is X, Y, or Z, and that they can show my guides exactly how they've done it, and therefore my guides be confident that they've reached the right conclusion.
Do people take them seriously, though? Because there's a reasonable degree of reality that people who come on wildlife watching trips tend to be slightly more experienced in life, and they tend to have a bit of money. And if you've got an 18-year-old boy or girl leading the group, that's a big ask.
I don't think we are suggesting that you will end up with an 18-year-old leading a group by themselves in the first instance. All those people who've been through the course know that they have a huge amount of knowledge and experience after 12 months, but that's only the end of the beginning. And if they want to go on and develop, then they are going to have to continue doing exactly the same sort of field work and asking themselves exactly the same sort of identification questions that we've given them the knowledge to work out for themselves. And much as I would love to be in a position to say we could take on lots of 18-year-olds, I know that they are going to be older than that before we can actually allow them to go out by themselves. But we have young people who are co-leading tours with other experienced guides, because that's the way they're actually going to learn how to be a full-blown tour leader. You won't do it any other way other than going out with people who know what they're doing and going through it and practicing and getting experience. It won't come from a textbook. It will only come from being in the great outdoors.
Sally Dowden, owner of Space Island Wildlife. Sounds... and a great opportunity for two young people there.
Yeah, because I originally thought it was going to be a 2-week course. 12 months, you can pick up a whole heap of knowledge.
We haven't, but
we've been doing this for decades and picked up almost nothing. Oh, there's a swift up there.
Why?
Oh, yeah.
That's fantastic. His scimitar wings.
Beautiful.
Wonderful wee animals. So there's three of them.
There you go.
Another two there. Now we've seen them all now. The swifts are back.
3 decades of wildlife broadcasting and we can spot three swifts.
Tick VG for effort. Sadly, that's all we've got time for in this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thanks very much for downloading us from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this, you know, moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.